My name is Steve Kontakis. Thank you for coming to this session. I'm an assistant professor of chemistry at Westmont College. I've been there 6 years now. And what I want to talk about is what I do in my classes. So when I got to Westmont, we don't have a required history and philosophy of chemistry class or science, where they do science and faith. We're supposed to do that in our classes. So I was probably the first person hired after that became a requirement or something that was assessed as part of our faculty evaluation process. And so it was a little bit of a problem for me to figure out how to do this, in a somewhat rigorous way. I don't claim this is rigorous, but that was what I was trying to do. And one of the tools that I've started to use is this topic. And so that's the background to what I'm doing. So that's what I'm going to tell you about today. And the tool is atomic molecular theory. And the place where I see it fits in is alongside some commonly used episodes in science and faith teaching. So not wanting to reinvent the wheel, I took a look at science and religion textbooks. So if you look at some of the good textbooks, like the ones by Alistair McGrath or Christopher Southgate's edited volume, God, Humanity, and the Cosmos, very early on, they'll take students through three episodes in the history of science and faith that they use really to nuance students' understanding and to kind of help them to see how science and faith have interacted in history. Those are the Galileo affair. Then there's the clockwork universe, which is usually what they emphasize is the love affair gone wrong, you know, how it led to deism. And then there were 19th century Christian reactions and dealing with Darwin's origin of species. And what's nice about these episodes is they let students see faith science dialogue in all its real world messiness. You know, the Galileo affair was not just about Galileo being right and the church being obstinate and backwards. It's not what it was. That's a caricature. When students see that, it really kind of helps them to see that there's more there. It also helps to diffuse popular meta-narratives like science defeats faith, you know, or they're always in conflict. And so they can kind of analyze it and see that's not quite the case. And the other thing that it helps them to see is that historical trajectories and issues can project into the present. Now, this is great. I love these episodes. And when I do a senior seminar course, our students will go through these in detail. But the problem is that these episodes don't fit nicely into the chemistry curriculum. It doesn't work for me to suddenly stop talking about matter and bring up Galileo and astronomy. That's for a physics course. And our students, because it's a liberal arts college, some of them, I must admit, will take physics senior year. And it's not ideal, but that's what they do. And so it's really hard to use these episodes to give them that nuance early on. So the episode that we do use, or I try to use, is Atoms and Christianity. The reason I choose it is because atomic molecular theory is arguably, not very arguably, the cornerstone of modern chemistry. We think in terms of atoms, we think in terms of molecules, we've built upon that thinking, and about virtually everything they do throughout the curriculum is going to build upon that thinking, with the possible exception of classical thermodynamics. And so we bring up this issue early. I must admit that at the time we bring it up, I usually do not make a lot of mileage out of it at that time. We usually talk about Ian Barber's four models for relating science and religion, but it gives our students enough nuance so that all of the other discussions we have, we can kind of refer back to it and say, well, look, this issue is also a little bit in play here, and Christians learn to deal with it. And even more important than that, it also represents an issue where it teaches students that science or religion dialogue has happened in the past, and things that we think are crazy, you know, why would someone think there's something wrong with atoms, once were these sort of hot-button issues, and the church got over it. Christians got over it, and so there's hope and for them to engage in science and religion dialogue. And I'm not saying that there actually are no problems left with with Adams. But by and large, I bet virtually none of you here came in wondering whether atomic molecular theory was a threat to your faith. In fact, you may have come because you're curious to find what is this crazy thing all about. Now, as I dive into the story, I want to just admit I am a learner of the story. There are others who have told this story very well before me, and I'd be happy to discuss references with you if you'd like afterwards or you want to implement this in your own coursework. For now, I'll just point you to Jack Haas has a nice little page on Adams and atheism, which is a great little page you can assign for your students to read. It doesn't bring out all the issues necessarily in excruciating detail, but it's a great starting point and very useful for an assignment. The story of atomism begins, it actually begins in India, but for our purposes it's helpful to think about it in the philosophical speculations of the Greeks about change. And Parmenides said, change is illusory. Something new can't come from nothing, so it's kind of an illusion. And Leucippus and Democritus kind of responded to this and came with the idea that change must occur as these tiny, geometrically indivisible atoms sort of move through this void. At least that's sort of a consensus of their views. And so that was kind of where the Greek atomism sort of generally is thought to begin. And all was well and good. In fact, some ideas about the atoms, if you want to get an idea of how they thought, they thought in terms of physical objects, and you can explain some things with atoms. So if you have smooth, round atoms, they can roll past each other. You get something like water. If they have barbs on them or they're rough, they kind of stick together, and you have things like iron. So it was very much sort of this, people thought of atoms as not only having size and mass, but also, or weight, but also having a shape at that point in time. Now, the place where atomism starts to become a theological problem is in the hands of Epicurus. So Epicurus was primarily an ethical philosopher, and he was concerned with liberating mankind from the tyranny of the gods. And atomism was part and parcel of his plan to do that. And so that is why he claimed the universe is only composed of matter and void. And what he did was he sort of withdrew God from atoms, or withdrew the divine influence from atoms. Atoms became these inert things, and his sort of follower, popularizer, Lucretius, wrote this really elegant poem on the nature of things, and he said things like, nature is her own mistress, accomplishing everything by herself, spontaneously and independently, free from the jurisdiction of the gods. And this became a theological problem even in ancient Greece and Rome, and certainly for the early church. In fact, Clement of Alexandria claimed that when Paul was speaking about empty philosophizings, that he was referring to Epicurus and his philosophy. Some of the church fathers, Lactantius and Augustine, both wrote against it. And you can see Lactantius's concerns from this quote here in his book on the anger of God. He said, by what plan, by what arrangement of the confused heap did the atoms collect themselves, that from some of them in space below the earth should be conglobulated, and that in the space above the sky should be spread, marked with such a great variety of stars that nothing more beautiful could ever be imagined? Can he who sees things so great and of such a kind believe they were brought about by no plan, no providence, by no divine reason, but that such great marvels have been compacted by finite and minute particles? And you see here the central issue is that nature is conceived of as something in and of itself self-sufficient. And so it was really widely perceived as incompatible. The church at that time and later never officially condemned atomism. They kind of really focused on, or at least when they talked about it, they always sort of tried to connect it with these other concerns, ethical concerns, or a view of a God-free universe. Now, even though they never condemned it, it didn't mean most medieval thinkers were free to think about atomism. In fact, most medieval thinkers did not know about atomism. Aristotle's earth, air, fire, and water theory actually seemed to make sense to them. And I know that seems crazy to us today, so I'm going to go through the classical illustration that was used by chemists for many, or proto-chemists, alchemists for many years, and that is the burning of wood. So when you burn wood, what happens? you get fire. It comes out of the wood. If you look, you also see smoke. There's a rushing of air. And if you sort of put a cold thing on top of the fire, you can condense some water. And what's left over is some ash, some earth. And so you could explain this as the separation of wood into its four components, earth, air, fire, and water. And they use these kind of explanations to explain change. And in the age of the Middle Ages, this was a perfectly reasonable explanation. In fact, there was no real evidence for atoms at the time, so it didn't really make sense to make a big deal about it. In fact, when the texts of Epicurus and Lucretius' writings were rediscovered, they were disseminated, they were taught. It was taught really originally as part of Aristotle's writings, because he wrote against Epicurus and Lucretius. And generally, the church did not make a big deal about it. There were a few cases where people who held atomistic ideas had their writings condemned, and famously, Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake. But that's always connected to things like denial of the Trinity, or something else that they taught in connection with atomism. So the church really practiced a wary toleration here. And because of that, it was always open to the idea as a scientific idea in some sense. And so after the idea sort of became more active in the European intellectual scene, and you have advances in astronomy by Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo, start to give people the idea that all of matter really behaves according to simple laws, people started to look for a mechanical explanation for the universe. In fact, that mechanical explanation will ultimately become something that they use as a support of faith, the design argument that became very popular at this time. And so there was an intellectual climate sort of conducive to mechanical explanations. At this point. And then you have people doing experiments on things like vacuum pumps. And so opposition to the void and the idea that there might be a void became something that people were seriously considering. And then the development of the scientific method based on empirical measurements and quantifying things also provided an opportunity to collect the kind of data that was going to support atomism. So what you have at the dawn of sort of the scientific revolution is you have a church that at least has remained open to atomism, and you have an intellectual environment that is sort of ready for atomism, but it's still associated with atheism. And so there were Christian thinkers that really, before atoms became a scientifically established idea, did the work to make it a philosophically and theologically acceptable idea. It doesn't mean they agreed with each other. And in fact, I will just warn anyone who wants to do this to keep this story very simple. I do it sort of inadvertently because I lack the training in the history and philosophy of science to do this right, so I tell a very simple version of this story. But you have René Descartes, and what René Descartes really does is he distinguishes between the material and spiritual, sort of a breakdown of the Aristotelian natures where things sort of have these tendencies built into them themselves. And so even though he wasn't an atomist, he sort of supports the mechanical universe. And the real hero of the story, though, is Pierre Gassendi, who was an atomist. In fact, he was a humanist, so he looked back into history and tried to find ancient authorities, and he found ideas that he thought were conducive to a mechanical universe in the writings of Epicurus. And he spent a lot of time trying to theologically rehabilitate atomism, and he asked the question, what are some of the things that led the church to reject atoms? Well, Epicureans tied the idea of atomism to the idea that the atoms were eternal, right? There's no beginning of the universe. There's no original creation act. The gods, or any god that's there, must be made of atoms. These are things that Epicurus taught, and Gassendi sort of stripped that away. He said, no, atoms are created by God. They're not eternal. Only God could destroy them. And so they can be consistent with divine providence and free will, at least in Gassendi's system. He tried to make them consistent with God's involvement in the creation of atoms. So diffuse a potential problem. Of course, very early on, and this is where the atom story ties into ties into the love affair gone wrong. Essentially, the love affair always had rocks and trouble in it. But you had Thomas Hobbes. He learned his atomism probably from Gassendi. And when he wrote his Leviathan, he really presented a fully materialist atomism. Without soul, with material souls, material deity, no free will. He had no moral absolutes, thought that all morality was human created. And this gave people a big shock because they felt like, well, wait a minute, these ideas are dangerous, right? Gassendi can take them one way and Hobbes can take them another way. So other people tried to react to that. And one reaction was the reaction of the Cambridge Platonists. And they sort of postulated an intermediary spiritual entity, like a spirit of nature, a plastic nature, which sort of enforced the laws of nature, or was how God worked to make nature consistent. Because a lot of the concerns at this time really had to do with sort of issues like miracles and chance, and how does God intervene, or if he puts forward laws, is he now bound by those laws? And then they're worried about natural evil. And so the Platonists kind of postulated this intermediary sort of entity. One of them, I actually forget which one right now, I'll remember it later, also did something kind of strange. He in one of his books, talked about how the Greeks learned atomism, and this comes from Strabo, from a Phoenician sage, which he identified as Moschus. So it was Moschus from Phoenicia, which, of course, is Moses of the Old Testament. Of course, if Moses gave you atomism, well, it must be good, right? And I usually bring this up not as some kind of evidence of, you know, sound philosophical reasoning, but because social factors are important. You know, a lot of our students come nervous about science and faith because their churches have educated them to be nervous of science and faith. People in authority, like Paul was talking about earlier, you know, told them these two things are incompatible. And because the Platonists sort of established this link, that kind of also diffused some of the concerns. And then in Robert Boyle's hands, you almost have an attempted kind of reversal of Epicureanism. So he's one of the origins of kind of this idea of a clockwork universe, where the universe is fully functioning. God designed it that way. It's really an evidence for God's providence. And some people even believe that behind Boyle's work was a desire to experimentally provide evidence for this rational universe and so support the existence of God logically, to sort of push back atheism. So it's if Epicurus was trying to free men from the tyranny of faith, Boyle was trying to sort of use science to use the atomic idea to also kind of help bring them back to faith, help kind of show them that this was reasonable. In fact, he endowed the Boyle lectures, which were sort of lectures on natural theology as part of his will. And some people will say that this is one of the transitions from theologizing about nature to moving to natural theology, at least natural theology in the William Paley kind of vein. So really, atomic theory here is intimately tied up with some of the strands and how people think about science and religion here. And later on, as we encounter these other themes, it's helpful to kind of refer back to this. You also see that these Christian thinkers, by and large, are helping the society around them to think about nature in new ways, in really ways that are pastorally open to atomic ideas. And then this is usually where the textbook story picks up. So these ideas come right out of the chem textbook, where you have Robert Boyle's research program as a quantitative research program. Lavoisier finds the law of conservation of mass by applying quantitative measurements. Joseph Proust finds the law of constant proportions, which means that the ratio of masses of elements in a compound is always the same. And Dalton notes the law of multiple proportions, which when you have two different compounds formed by the same two elements, the ratio of the ratios is a whole number, which you'd only get if you have things like carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. And this is what leads Dalton to note the law, the atomic theory. And what I will also try and point out here is that of these characters, you know, Boyle is a devout Christian. Arguably, his writings on Christianity and devotion are more important in his mind than his scientific ones. Proust writes the Bridgewater Treatise that dealing with chemistry, and Dalton's a devout Quaker. You know, so these people were serious about their faith as they went and led to atomic theory. And here's sort of a page from Dalton's book where he explained these laws. And again, this is just right out of the general chemistry course. I don't usually tell this story at this time, but I mention it as a potential additional linkage. But throughout the 19th century, chemists were somewhat positivists about the identity of atoms. They didn't necessarily subscribe to them as real physical things. They were more agnostic on that question. They thought of them as units of chemical combination. And that's even somewhat true for people like Van't Hoff, who come up with the tetrahedral atom. They were sort of saying these were useful manipulation aids. And that sort of is a little bit of an idea that Boyle kind of had, that these models are useful to us. It's also a stream that continues a little bit in chemistry today. One of the results of that, and I don't think it's a very direct linkage, is that when people began to be concerned about these deistic ideas, and here's a quote from Aubrey Moore in reaction to Darwin, saying how great Darwin was because he sort of defeated deism. Okay, let me just skip this then and go. Einstein pretty much establishes atoms via his explanation of atomic molecular, Brownian motion. And Jean Perrin does the experiments to back him up. And by that point, virtually all chemists believe in their physical reality. And today, even though the story is told in Gen Chem books that we can now see atoms using scaling tunneling microscopes, there are still sort of interesting philosophical questions about the reality and reductionism in chemistry that you can kind of tie back to this story. One of the things I do end with is that students, when I tell the story in like a Gen Chem or a non-majors Gen Chem, is that, you know, to some extent, you can't fully pull apart scientific and theological ideas. There's always the idea of how we think about the world and divine action hanging out there. So I actually advocate sort of a critical methodological naturalism. I definitely advocate methodological naturalism, but I say let's be critical about how we present science. I also encourage them that we have a responsibility, you know, and they have a responsibility as Christian students sort of learning science to promote Christian-friendly interpretations, to be a pastor to Christians who don't know science. And then I usually bring this quote in by C.S. Lewis that the best way to do it is to present your science as faithfully as possible, but bringing your faith assumptions kind of into it. And so with that, I'll close and open it up for questions. Yeah, that's a very controversial argument. Not a lot of people accept that. And what some people have pointed out is that everything in the document that he claims to have found is public knowledge. And so I choose not to discuss that because I don't feel that that's an established historical fact. And certainly any sort of public documents from the Galileo affair and things we know from the time don't show that atomism played a large role, or there's probably no direct evidence for that. I couldn't agree more. I think one of the things that I try to do as our students sort of leave, you know, in our senior seminar class and in some of the advanced labs, is to help students situate themselves in the history of science so that they're part of an enterprise that they can contribute to, that we're passing the baton on to them and that they get to pick up the story. So yeah, I don't think we do them any favor when we portray it as all these body of facts. You know, I hadn't thought of that. One of our historians also runs this Reacting to the Past class, and that would be a really fun kind of exercise. I'm not entirely sure how I would do it with atomism. I could see an easy way to do it with the Galileo affair. Yeah, I actually, why don't we talk afterwards?